Cubberty on 2FM with Super Value Travel Insurance. Holidaying at home or abroad? Don't worry about a thing with Great Value Travel Insurance at supervalue.ie.
This is coming towards 9:30 now, and a lot of people may have seen Louis Theroux's latest two-part documentary, By Reason of Insanity, it was called, and it offers an insight to America's state psychiatric hospitals, introducing us to patients who had committed crimes, at times really, really violent, and while in the grip of severe mental illness. And these patients had been found, in this case, not guilty by reason of insanity. There's something you hear a lot of, and they were ordered by the courts to secure psychiatric facilities to receive the treatment that it hoped will one day lead to their reintegration back into society. So we thought we'd go closer to home, obviously, and to the Central Mental Hospital in Dundrum. And Professor Harry Kennedy is the clinical director of that particular hospital. And he joins us this morning. Welcome to the programme.
Good morning, Ryan.
When you're young, you don't think, I'd love to run the mental hospital in Dundrum when I'm older. So what did you want to be when you were little?
When I was little, I wanted to be a GP.
You want to be a doctor?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a doctor.
Help the community, yeah.
Yeah. After UCD and the matter, I went to London. I spent about 5 years doing chest medicine, looking inside people's lungs with fibre optic bronchoscopes.
Right.
Look, doing things with the lungs of people who had AIDS before we knew what it was.
Okay.
And about that time, my wife had switched to psychiatry. And I would go into the Hammersmith Hospital in London, the Royal Postgraduate Medical School, and talk to people over coffee about a film by Akira Kurosawa, and they'd look at me like I had two heads. And then I'd talk to my wife's friends and colleagues, and they knew about Japanese films. They seemed to be having a, you know, more tuned into what
more
I was
in common
in.
With them, yeah.
Yeah. So I switched.
Right, almost as a result of Japanese movies.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Because well, they were on your wavelength, essentially, and they were talking about things that were of interest to you.
It was the mixture of good science, but the humanities as well. You know, that combination of things, which is actually the roots of medicine. There's always the two parts of it.
Yeah, I really believe that. That even if you take law or any other of the professions, that if you have a basis in humanities and study a bit more of the world, it'll give you a more global, worldly sense of the place rather than that narrow focus of just medicine or law or whatever it might be.
Yes, yeah, it's part of knowing what's going on around you. And I find actually that a good novel often tells you more about people's minds or a particular type of a mind than an awful lot of psychology books.
Yeah, yeah, you get an insight into the world that you won't get from a manual, I suppose, in some regards. So you went into psychiatry, and did you, was it a massive leap from checking out people's lungs and so forth and into then people's minds?
No, it is a medical subject.
Yes.
And what psychiatrists like me do is look after people who have really very, very severe, very disabling brain diseases. Mm-hmm. But of course, it's very difficult to recognise a brain disease. It's not like a skin disease where it's obvious to everyone, but it's still there.
Yeah, and it's not like neurology, which of course is something much more physical in some regards than mental, which is where you're going. Is there a way that when you meet somebody that's unwell, how long does it take you to kind of come to terms with or come to find out what's wrong with them or get the measure of them?
Well, people come to us for a reason. Yeah. You know, they're usually referred to us for a reason. What you try to do, I suppose, is not to look at your friends too closely in that way.
Yeah.
But often the people that we see in Dundrum are actually already in the media before they come anywhere near us.
By that you mean that they've been in the courts or what have you?
They've been, you know, a proportion of people who come to us are very high profile, but far more commonly, and the vast majority of people that we come across in our clinics, we do our clinics in prisons, are people who've done very trivial but, you know, unwise things, daft things sometimes, you know, shouting in the street, breaking a window, and they find themselves in prison.
Yeah. Are they mentally ill?
Yes, usually the ones that we see are. It's actually a really interesting way that mental health services have developed, because if you're a young man now in Ireland or in a lot of countries who develop schizophrenia, for example,
very common,
you have a fair chance of spending some of your life in prison, because in bygone days you would have spent a lot of your life in an asylum. Now there aren't any asylums, and the kind of deal is that you don't spend any time very much in a hospital at all, but you might well spend some time in a prison.
Yeah.
It's a really interesting question whether that's a good deal.
Yeah, of course. And what's your take on that?
Well, I think people get very confused in the way, particularly, actually, genuine people who think about human rights get mixed up about this, because there's a difference between being libertarian and being liberal. So being libertarian is a very American thing, which means that freedom is your first priority. It's more important than anything else. And a liberal view is actually, although we don't often think of it this way, it's about caring for other people and sometimes actually about the obligation to help other people. And that gets called paternalism, which gets a bad name.
Yeah.
Now, if we called it maternalism,
That's another
nobody
story.
Would think it was a bad thing.
You're
you
just
know?
Mammering the poor creature. Yeah. How come one person with schizophrenia can get through life with all the torment of it and not become difficult societally and then end up in Dundrum, and somebody else ends up in Dundrum for a long, long time?
Well,
with the same illness.
Well, a lot of what happens in life is accidental. You know, who knows how, you know, we were talking earlier how I started off wanting to be a GP and I end up working in the Central Mental Hospital. Yeah. We all have accidental careers, and it's a bit like that. Some people have mild or moderate or severe forms of a mental illness like schizophrenia, though it's often quite severe.
Yeah.
But just because a person is in trouble or stays out of trouble, it doesn't necessarily mean that they have made bad choices deliberately, though they may have made bad choices because of their illness. Mm. And again, this is something that's really difficult to grasp, because we all think of ourselves as independent and autonomous, making our own decisions.
Yeah.
But sometimes we all have blind spots. You know, there are things you can't get. You know, I could listen to opera for 1,000 years and I wouldn't get it. Now, if it was the case that you were trying to work out the right thing to do in a human relationship and were similarly tone deaf to other people's thoughts or minds or feelings, you could find yourself making really bad mistakes and even ending up in the courts because of them. But that is actually one of the things we're newly recognising in severe mental illness, is that there's a very interesting overlap between things we used to think were different. So we used to think, for instance, that schizophrenia and bipolar affective disorder were very different, but we now know that there's a huge overlap between them.
Mm.
And what's really interesting, particularly emerging from the genetics department in Trinity, where I have a link, I'm not a geneticist, but I'm extremely glad to work with academic colleagues there. And what they're finding is that there is an interesting overlap, for example, between schizophrenia and things like autism and some of the forms of intellectual disability.
Mm.
And so you do get people who, even when their delusions and hallucinations aren't so bad, because we're quite good at treating that now, but they still have this problem with understanding other people and understanding social situations, what actually you could call common sense.
Yeah.
And we've all not been aware of the necessity to look at this as a handicap. If you lack the ability to understand other people because of an illness, you make serious mistakes. And most types of mental health law, most types of human rights protections don't actually get in there to support people like that.
When you watch a big court case unfolding in the media or whatever, in the courts, and sometimes it's a violent crime, and then the person who perpetrated the crime is not sent to prison, Mountjoy or whatever, Arbor Hill, but is sent to Dundrum because by reason of insanity.
Yes.
Do you ever think some of the people who get into Dundrum, or admitted to Dundrum for committing a crime by reason of insanity, have actually managed to pull the wool over your eyes? Because there's no physical manifestation of the illness. It's mental. So if somebody is smart enough, could they outfox you and avoid going to prison and end up in Dundrum?
Anybody can be deceived, including a doctor, including a psychiatrist. That, you know, and it's very important to start off recognising that, because it sort of then gives you enough immunization to hope that doesn't happen very much. Things like that can sometimes happen. The courts have a big role in making these decisions, actually, about who goes to Dundrum for longer periods of time. People who are very high profile in the media like that, who have trials that the media report, have usually been in the Central Mental Hospital for about a year before their trial. And, you know, if you're being cared for and interacted with and spoken with day and night for a year by nurses mainly, and also by doctors and psychologists and social workers and occupational therapists,
yes,
it's very hard to maintain an act day and night all that time.
Yeah, I understand. I was watching this Louis Theroux program at the weekend. It was from a couple of months ago, and he was in one such institution in America, and he was showing this man was being released from the prison having had schizophrenic related illness. And for me as an armchair viewer, which I was, looking at the psychiatrist saying to him, "Are you sure you're okay?" And he was going, "Yeah," and that's good, okay. And he was talking to Louis Theroux, and he wasn't, you know, he wasn't balanced and he wasn't well adjusted. You could see it in his eyes, and he was almost starting to break down, going, I'll be fine. And then she wobbled, but she let him go. And you just thought, God, what? Like, that's a massive thing to release somebody from your care in Dundrum and hoping that they can integrate, having been borderline institutionalized. It's a huge responsibility on you and your colleagues' behalf to let out somebody who has committed, say, very violent crime, maybe even murder, to say, out you go, you're grand now.
Yes. Again, there are two things that kind of help in doing that, because it's very important to recognize that people can and do recover. As I've said, we're very good now with medication for things like delusions and hallucinations. But just because you've fixed that doesn't mean that there aren't other things that need help and support, as we've been saying. And so people who have been found not guilty by reason of insanity, after periods of time, often quite long periods of time, can be given what's called a conditional discharge by an independent judicial body, which is called the Mental Health Review Board, which is set up by an act of the Dáil. And they are then sort of released to a supportive program, which they're obliged to comply with, which ensures, for instance, that they have a decent place to live and that they have things to keep them busy during the day, work or other activities, creative activities sometimes, that their medication is okay, that they're taking it, that it's working for them, that they're not using drink and drugs. Ordinary common sense things which do help to keep people well, people out of trouble.
I was interviewing a woman on the Late Show, a lady a few months ago, whose brother had committed had killed their father. You may or may not have seen it, but it was her brother killed their father. And he's currently in Dundrum, she told us. And she has to go and visit him. And from what I got the impression she was saying was that the man who killed their father is not the man she goes to see in Dundrum. Does that make sense?
Well, General comment.
I'll
tell you, one of the really satisfying things about seeing somebody for the first time in a remand prison like Clover Hill, who has probably had no medication for 6 months or a year, and is as extremely ill as you can get. Students come to us to see things that they read about in textbooks because you don't see them anywhere else, except nowadays in prisons, where people have had absolutely no medication for a long time, is that they are angry, they're defensive, they're sensitive, they're touchy. These are all the plain English versions of what paranoia is a lot of time, or they're overwhelmingly manic and disinhibited and all over the place, or they're very down in themselves. The extremes of moods, of confused thought. And after they've been with us in hospital and being treated with legal powers, often given treatment that they don't want to have, for a month or two or three with medication, their true personality emerges as the paranoia, as the anger, as the fear goes away, initially with medication. Then and only then do you see the kind of friendly, decent, reasonable person that is the healthy personality.
When they shed that illness skin, if you like.
And a normal personality blossoms and emerges, sometimes for the first time in years. And it's at that stage, actually, that the real therapeutic work starts, because that's when you can have therapeutic conversations.
Is there such thing as a fairly typical patient in Dundrum, or is it? Could you give us a kind of a test case?
Well, it's a very generally known thing. I suppose the majority of our patients are men, but they're not all men. They're mostly in their 20s to 40s. They mostly have schizophrenia or another very severe mental illness like that. Sometimes intellectual disability or autism, but mostly schizophrenia. And typically they have been diagnosed with schizophrenia in their late teens, early 20s. They've been ill for 5 to 10 years. And about a year before they come into us, they decide to stop taking their medication, stop seeing their doctors. And then something pretty dire happens, and they find themselves in prison, and then they find themselves in Dundrum.
Is it very distressing for families in the opening few months to have to come into Dundrum and visit their loved ones?
Yes. And again, you know, I don't want to generalise about families particularly, I hope many of whom may be listening to us, but very often there's a genuine fear because of the aspects of the illness that are due to the illness, the anger, the paranoia, the sensitivity, the taking offence for nothing. And once the person begins to recover themselves, once their underlying personality emerges again, then it's often a really satisfying thing for families. Families see somebody they knew 5 or 6 years ago that they haven't seen for a few years. Sometimes there'll have been no contact at all, or they will have been interacting with this angry, unhappy person.
I had family growing up around Dundrum all my life, and I've always passed the hospital gates and the walls. They're daunting. They look Victorian in their, you know, greyness and tallness, if you like. I've never stepped through the gates, and I'm wondering if you could kind of paint a picture for us. What's it like beyond the gates there on a given day? And is it all very modern and high tech? And, you know, is it a warm place? Can such a place be welcoming? I mean, it's a naive almost question, but I suppose for many people, it's just that they're the walls.
It's quite unlike any other forensic hospital anywhere.
Yeah.
It opened in 1850. It's the oldest working forensic hospital in Europe or North America, possibly in the world. Mm. Inside, it's actually a really, really nice space. There are 34 acres laid out by the Victorians with specimen trees. We have two guys who look after the grounds for us, Kevin and Anthony, who are artists. And, you know, I always talk about the space inside the walls as a kind of soft machine for helping people recover.
Right.
The building is a typical architecturally elegant Victorian asylum made of Wicklow granite, like the walls outside. Beautiful architecture from the outside, completely out of date and completely inappropriate and unsafe inside, unfortunately.
To this day?
Yes. Again, if you go back to about 2000, our patients were slopping out. It was that bad. Now, we've completely overcome that problem. But it's a building that is so old and so inflexible that it cannot be modernised. We've had architects do reports on it.
And nothing.
Nothing can be done with it. We're hoping that we will move to a new purpose-built hospital in Portrane. We're waiting anxiously for planning permission for that, which should come sometime soon, we hope.
Right.
That's all I can say.
Fingers
about that, of course.
What do patients do all day? Do you show them movies? Do they play games? I mean, it's a long time to be incarcerated. That's probably not the right word, but to be in the hospital. So what do you do for stimulation?
Well, the hospital, I suppose, is divided into three stages as people recover. The first is an acute, very intensively staffed, intensive care series of wards. Then people go after perhaps a few months, if they're staying with us a long time. Most people stay with us only a few months and go back to their local services. But those who stay a long time move to our medium wards, where there is still quite intensive staffing, and then on to our recovery units just before they leave the hospital.
Yeah.
The day consists of, I suppose, work and leisure and therapy. The therapies are in what we call five pillars. So you have to have attention to your physical health. There's no mental health without physical health. Mental health itself, which is often mainly about education, about the nature of illness and how to stay well. Drugs and alcohol, because that's a huge problem on top of mental illness for most of our patients. We are very different, I suppose, from a lot of modern substance misuse approaches, because we're all about abstinence, not about harm reduction. Then there's treatments, predominantly psychological and psychoeducational treatments for problem behaviours like anger or how to have a healthy relationship with other people. And the fifth one, which is in many ways the most important, which is about getting on with family and work and education and fulfilment in various ways. Work, there's a dignity in work, there's fulfilment in work. And sometimes for people who are so disabled that they can't even do that, there's creativity.
My father, who was a psychiatrist back in the day, was, I remember him...
And very well remembered.
Well, that's nice of you to say so. But I remember him describing to me once about looking into, through people, looking at padded cell. And he was very disturbed by it. He thought it wasn't the way forward. That was his feeling. He said that he described the slow movement of the patient, restricted, and he just, for whatever way he, his mind worked from a heart and soul point of view and a medical point of view, he said that's not great. Would you have an opinion on the padded cell or the straight jacket or any of these things?
There was actually a literally padded cell in the hospital, I remember, back to the year 2000. We don't have a literally padded cell now, but there are people who are so much of a danger to other people as well as themselves when they first come to us, who do spend time in special suites where they are looked after on their own for as short a period of time as possible.
What does the suite mean? What does it...
It's a seclusion area. It has its own bathroom. But it means that people have time, often time to reconsider themselves. It's time apart where somebody who has done something really undignified, like lashing out
within the hospital,
within an admission ward, lashing out, smashing things, hitting other people, that they have time to literally to compose themselves.
Do you have, like in the movies, like stocky orderlies in the event of, in the event of, somebody getting out of control, attacking, or is it just regular staff like, the nurses and what have you?
Look at me, what am I? I'm 5'8". Yeah. I'm not quite as thin as you,
No,
Ryan,
but you're not a million miles off. But I'm just saying, if...
Most of our staff are actually young women.
And are any of them ever physically harmed?
Sometimes, I'm not going to say never. What we do is risky, but that's minimised through terrific skills, and the skills are mostly about how to talk situations down. It's mostly
because you hear about psychiatric nurses sometimes being kicked or punched, and we heard about that teacher who came out with that recently, who was caring in a caring scenario. But it's not that unphysical is what I'm saying. A question says, I've always been curious about the people who plead insanity to a crime when it's obvious that they are just inherently evil and trying to get out of jail. This kind of echoes what I was saying to you earlier on, where they might outfox you. Is it hard to differentiate between the two when referred?
Well, actually, I can't think of many cases like that. I've been doing this sort of work since 1985. I was doing this in London long before I came back here. Very few people want to pretend to be legally insane. It happens, but it's very unusual. In Ireland, actually, unlike other countries, courts can't find somebody legally insane unless they plead insanity first. And that has a really interesting knock-on effect, because actually a lot of our time is spent in prison with people who have got really long sentences, who are completely unwell, should have been found legally insane,
but didn't plead it.
But just decide not to plead it.
Do you think you've ever met anyone evil?
I have, yes.
And how do you know somebody's evil? And you're looking at me as if to say, "How do you think, you fool?" But tell me, because I don't know.
Next thing I was going to say, Ryan, is that I'm a doctor. I'm not a priest or a judge.
Exactly.
I'm interested in people's minds. I'm interested in the way that illnesses might impair a person's ability to think straight and make decisions.
So what would an evil person say or do that makes you think you are an evil person?
Again, I'm not a lawyer either, but a person who is culpable for something they've done is somebody who knows, intends what they're doing, and is well enough to be responsible for making that decision.
So of sound mind.
Yes.
But immorally, utterly unsound. Or morally, I should say, utterly unsound.
Well, yes, and moral judgments. The experts on that in every modern country are juries, interestingly. Okay. 12 members of the public are the proper judges of people in that way.
Do you think paedophiles can be cured?
The interesting thing about paedophilia is that what makes it a crime, of course, is acting. So, for example, if you're very, very fond of fast cars, lots of people are fond of fast cars, but very few people steal them. Lots of people, everybody has a sexual orientation. Everybody, okay, there's a famous Jimmy Carter quote about often having sinned in my heart.
Yes, yes, yes.
That's very different from acting illegally.
So take that to its logical conclusion then and answer the question.
There are orientations that cannot be changed.
Yeah. So you could put a paedophile in prison for 20 years and they'll come out and do it again.
Well, the do it again, you see, is not the same as the orientation.
Well, committing the act of paedophilia, which is an utterly heinous crime.
If you put a car thief who is just somebody who's really, really fond of Lamborghinis and yeah. only ever steals Lamborghinis, if you put him in prison for 20 years... He will come out still really, really fond of Lamborghinis, but he mightn't steal any.
I'd rather meet a car thief than a paedophile, though.
Everybody has children, and we all care more deeply about our children than anything else, yeah. and that's very important.
But I'm just fascinated that you think that they're incurable. I think that doesn't surprise me at all.
But perhaps unchangeable is a better term than incurable.
Yeah. Do you like your job? I mean, it sounds like not only fascinating and intriguing, but challenging. Do you find because of the nature of psychiatry, it's a constant quest for knowledge, isn't it? There's no black and white issue with it.
What really attracted me to it originally is that it's less developed than other areas of medical science, and there is a real science underneath this. It is about how brains work, and it's also about how populations work.
Yeah,
all of that sort of keeps me interested. If talking to patients is the thing that is the most interesting thing you can do, but the research and the teaching, that's all very interesting too.
Well, it's been an extraordinary insight into this world, and I really appreciate you coming along today and being so frank about what it is you do, and wish you and your colleagues well at the Central Mental Hospital in Dundrum. Professor Harry Kennedy, Clinical Director of the Central Mental Hospital, thanks for your time this morning.
Thank you, Ron.